This is Rebecca from New Haven, Connecticut. You are listening to WNHH Community Radio 103.5 FM.
Welcome to Book Talk, where we talk about books. I'm Sid Oppenheimer, and today we'll be talking about the novel Mr. Penumbra's 24-Hour Bookstore, first with the author, Robin Sloan, and then with my guests, Tui Sutherland and Alfie Guy. And stay tuned at the end of the show for a middle grade recommendation from one of our friendly New Haven librarians. Clay Janin is a web designer without a job, a 20-something victim of the Great Recession, who finds himself wandering the streets of San Francisco looking for help wanted signs. That's how he wanders into Mr. Penumbra's 24-hour bookstore, and into Mr. Penumbra, the very old, very blue-eyed man who greets him with the question, "What do you seek in these shelves?" Mr. Penumbra hires him for the night shift on three conditions. He must always be on time and not leave early. He must never browse, read, or otherwise inspect the shelved volumes in the back. And he must record, in a leather-bound tome, precise records of all transactions, the time, the customer's appearance, whether his buttons are stone or jade. All quests begin with a set of rules, and all adventures begin when the rules are broken. Clay looks in the books, and the adventure unfolds, taking him from the top shelves of his San Francisco bookstore to the underground vaults of New York, from the headquarters of Google to a storage warehouse in Nevada, from the 16th century to the present day. He seeks to solve an age-old mystery, and in doing so, to answer the eternal question, how, if at all, can we achieve immortality? I had the opportunity last week to speak with author Robin Sloan, and I'd like to share that interview with you now. Robin Sloan grew up in Michigan and worked at Pointer, Current TV, and Twitter. Mr. Penumbra's 24-Hour Bookstore is his first novel. His second will be coming out in 2017. Robin, thanks so much for joining me today.
It is great to be here. Thanks.
So, Robin, this novel began as a short story that you self-published on your website, and which, in fact, is still up there if anyone wants to read it. And not every short story needs to be turned into a novel. The short story is really its own genre, and a lot of short stories, I feel like they're self-contained. They're finished things. So what made you feel like there was more to be told here?
That's a good question, and I have to admit, there's sort of an urge to say, well, of course, I knew from the beginning that there was a larger story stirring inside here, but that would not be truthful. In fact, I thought the story of Mr. Penumbra's 24-Hour Bookstore was done when I finished that short story, and that was largely in part because at that time, short stories were all that I'd ever written, and for me to write a continuous story of 6,000 words or 8,000 words that made sense and was fun to read was really like, that was like as much as I could muster. That was kind of the limit of my creative exertions. So in some ways, I didn't even dare to ever dream of longer stories. And it wasn't until my book agent, who I had met following the self-publication of that story and a few others that year, and who's still my agent today, she's the one who asked me. She said, you know, have you ever thought maybe there's a bigger story there? And as soon as she said it, I knew that that was probably the case, but I can't say that I would have realized that on my own.
So there are some significant differences between the short story and the novel. And I guess I'm curious about when you realized those things were going to be different, especially the ending. So, you know, the short story ends at a point which is sort of about halfway through the novel, I'd say. I mean, there are differences, but the mystery that's revealed in the short story is only kind of the first half of the mystery in the novel.
That's right. And again, I'm going to be candid. When I was writing the short story version, the kind of writer I was then, the sort of the way I had been trained or all the experience that I'd accrued had all come from writing for the internet. And I think this is a shared feeling by many writers for the internet. So there's this kind of ambient fear that if you go on too long or luxuriate or if let things get a little boring, people are just going to close the tab. Just this sense that we all have, I think, from reading on the internet, that there's always something else waiting, probably lined up, stacked up right behind this thing. And so just there's this sense of kind of urgency and like, okay, got to get it over with. And when I go back and read the short story version of Mr. Penumbra's 24-Hour Bookstore, I can detect that rush and that sort of panic to get it over with and just like, oh, yeah, here's a weird, mysterious 24-Hour Bookstore and there's a mystery and, oh, that's weird and here's the solution. Whew, made it. And part of learning to write a novel that exists in a different space and that people read very differently and have different expectations for and I think a lot more patience for was learning to take your time a little bit and learning that it's okay to luxuriate and let things spread out at least a little bit more. For me, that was a big departure from the kind of writing I'd been doing before.
Had you always been a reader?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, a reader before a writer, and I mean, still a reader foremost.
And so how did you learn to be a writer in that way, a writer, a non-internet writer, a novel writer? Was it by going back to the books that you read when you were younger that you still read today?
I would say that I am still in the process of learning or unlearning the things that I sort of got used to on the internet. It is definitely not a done deal. And I still catch myself rushing, hurrying, you know, getting nervous that a section is going to go on too long. Maybe all things being equal, that's not the worst problem to have, because of course we all have encountered books that are too long and too floppy and you kind of wish the author would have hurried up a little bit and gotten to the point. But I'm still on my way on that journey. And I would say for me, the process, I wish I could say I was more systematic about reading or rereading the books that I love. Instead, it's really in the drafting. You know, I sit down, I start to write something, and I catch myself either doing something wrong or doing something I think works right. And then I try to either change course or, you know, take a break and return to it. Or if it feels right and it feels like I'm writing like a novel writer today, then, you know, I keep it going for as long as I can.
So I'm really interested in questions of process, and this in particular kind of fascinates me because you have this short story and you're going to turn it into a novel. And when I looked at it on your website, it was interesting because there are certain scenes that appear in the short story and appear in the novel, but in a much more expanded form. And I wondered, how did you do that? I mean, where do you begin to turn it into the novel? Do you start with the scenes you already have?
This. Yeah, I love those questions too. Those like really practical. I feel like I'm always pushing people towards like, no, literally, where, like, what did you copy and paste? In this case, I can say I do remember, because of course you can imagine a couple different approaches to the process of expanding and kind of readapting a short story into a longer work. In this case, this was copy and paste. You know, whatever document it was I first created that was going to be the repository for that initial rough draft of the novel, Mr. Penumbra's 24-Hour Bookstore, the first thing that went into that document was the full text of the short story. But at that point, I think pretty quickly I began breaking it up, trying to, and keeping in mind, this was all new to me. I mean, talk about unknown territory and just a new set of tasks and a new set of challenges. I was kind of feeling it out as I went, but I'm pretty sure I then broke it up into what I imagined might be chapters and had, you know, sort of a sense of like, write more here, or like, yeah, this should be a thing, fill that in. And then I did at the end, you know, one of the things I realized from the get-go was that the mystery, I wanted there to be a good, meaty, interesting mystery that I could kind of unfold over the course of the book. And the mystery in the book is different than the mystery in the short story, where there's kind of additional layers of mystery. And I kind of just sat down and tried to figure out what that would be. I had my notebook open and I thought, okay, what are some good mysteries? And came up with what I, you know, was ultimately excited about and what became the big mystery of Mr. Penumbra's 24-Hour Bookstore.
So that kind of leads me to my next question, which is when you're writing a book that has a mystery at the core, do you know the solution at the beginning or do you discover it along with your characters?
In my case, I knew the solution at the beginning when I sat down. And I didn't know all the details. I didn't know all the ins and outs and exactly how the solving of it would proceed. But I did know what I thought the mystery would be. And in fact, it's been funny to talk to people who have read the book and, you know, talk about it with people. I don't think that anyone else in the world, including the book's most ardent fans, think the mystery is as cool as I did. Mm-hmm. And I still do, which I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing. I mean, maybe that's the way it should be, that the author is kind of more enamored of the mystery than anyone else. But I do remember when I figured out what I wanted it to be and started sort of imagining how you could get there, I was like giggling to myself, you know, at the table with the laptop open, which it's just good. I think that's a good feeling.
So what were things that surprised you in writing the novel, if you did know what the solution was going to be? Were there things that you didn't expect to happen that kind of came to you?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, people often ask about sort of discovery versus process and outline. Mm-hmm. And for me, the answer is always somewhere in between. I mean, I do approach writing with some structure, and I have a sense of like, you know, okay, it's going to be this and this. And then, you know, I have an idea of something floating out there. But those things that I'm expecting to get to, they're not so much sequential plot points as they are often images, ideas, characters. And those are usually things that are gleaned from my copious, huge, kind of overflowing collection of notes I've taken over the years, just things I think are weird and interesting. So some of the things in Mr. Penumbra's 24-hour bookstore, I mean, there's, you know, sort of a strange museum space near the end of the book where all these strange things, you know, from all these museums around the world have been sent to be stored. And that was something that I had just thought of or kind of encountered. And it had been in my notes for years, the idea of that kind of space. I didn't know at the time that it got jotted down that it would end up as part of this book, as part of this story. So maybe one of the things I had discovered is like how those puzzle pieces fit together, because there were a bunch of those. A lot of the pieces that came together to form this story, they didn't come out of me sitting down thinking about Penumbra. They came from observations and, you know, weird encounters and daydreams years ago, and now they finally kind of came home to roost.
So the mystery, without giving too much away, has to do with typography.
Yes.
Aldus Manutius, who is one of the first publishers who lived in the 1500s, left behind this encrypted book, and the members of the Unbroken Spine have been seeking to decode over the years. And he left the key to the code with his friend Griffo Gerritsen, who is a designer of typeface. My husband, also strangely enough, is fascinated by typeface, which I have always found a little bizarre. But I wonder, was this always an interest of yours?
Yes, definitely always an interest. Of course, one of the great pleasures and luxuries of being a writer, I think probably nonfiction and fiction, is that you get to indulge your interests and maybe transform casual interests into deeper or almost professional interests. And in this case, that happened with typography. I was always interested in design and type and just the way words work and all that stuff. I can't say that I was a great scholar of typography or, you know, the way the mechanical sort of means of printing and hot type and the way it's all designed and produced and all that stuff. And so a lot of that stuff I learned over the process of writing the book. I read a lot of type history and I read about Manutius and that era. And that was fun. I mean, what a lovely thing to be able to do that for your job.
Do you have a sense of like what drew you to that? Why that was always an interest?
That's a good question. My first instinct, which might be a little facile or glib, is that my family always had a Macintosh computer ever since I was a little kid. We started with a Mac Plus down in the basement that my parents acquired somehow. And, you know, the Mac computers from their earliest days took typography so much more seriously than other computers. And I was always down there using that thing. So I feel like I was like in the business of choosing fonts kind of maybe a little bit before my peers, you know, other people who encountered them later, maybe, you know, when they're using computers in high school or in college. So maybe that's it. Maybe it's me and the Mac Plus down in the basement, you know, choosing fonts for weird documents.
There is this line in the book about Clay's roommate, Matt, who is he's an artist who builds things for movies. And there's this line about how this is his get out of free card. He makes things that are beautiful. And that was a line that really stayed with me for some reason. And I'm thinking about it now as we're talking about typeface and the notion of sort of aesthetic. And this is a book that, you know, it is not a book that is an anti-technology book. It's not a book that comes down, I don't think, like in favor of the book versus technology. It doesn't present them as opposed to each other. But I did find myself wondering if you feel like this, if the advance of technology means the loss of things that are beautiful.
So the answer to that has to be no, definitely not. But it's complicated. Of course it's complicated. And I think you see there's actually a great tension now. I, in my professional life, have spent some time, you know, thinking about the internet and the web and working with designers of, you know, phone apps and websites and things like that. And even in those communities, you see a real tension. You think about something, you know, as successful and useful as the Kindle, you know, the Amazon's e-reader, mm-hmm. and how now, whatever, almost a decade after its release, its typography is still so subpar. I mean, it can't and doesn't do the things that books do, simple things that have to do with justification and, you know, that the typeface really reflecting something about the book, things that book designers, physical book designers, take absolutely for granted as part of their work. So in that case, we definitely see that. We see a deficit of you know, flexibility and sort of the expressiveness of the medium. On the other hand, you sort of travel into the weird corners of the web, not so much the big commercial websites, but into people's personal websites or these websites that are more like zines, and you find pages in like ways of organizing words and images in space that are as cool and as beautiful as anything that a human being has ever put together. And not only are they beautiful in a static way, they like move around or the colors shift and kind of shimmer as you scroll down the page or something else that, you know, the Aldous Manutius era people would have never even imagined or dreamed was possible. So yeah, it's both, you know. I think that maybe too often, especially when a lot of money is involved and efficiency and scale, then beauty sort of gets neglected. But there's no question in my mind, at least, that the potential for beauty with these new tools and with things on the internet is as deep as anything else we've ever worked with.
So, to shift directions a little bit, I've done a few books on the show recently, a book called Behold the Dreamers by Imbolo Mboya and a book called The Wangs Versus the World by Jade Chang, that, like your book, are set during the Great Recession. And I wanted to ask you what I asked them, whether you felt like there was something about those years and what was going on in the economy in particular that made it important for the book to be set then, whether it somehow made the questions the characters or the book are asking more urgent.
That's a good question. I can't say that it was a super conscious decision, or I guess by that, I mean, I would never have considered setting it at a time other than now, you know, the now of writing it, only because I've always enjoyed books about now or people that try to do that, because it's hard, right? It's, you know, especially when it's really fresh, things we don't have sort of the benefit of hindsight, and we don't know what will appear important and what will appear ridiculous in a few years. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a few things in my novel that probably appear ridiculous even now, just a few years after its publication. And that's okay. I signed up for that risk. But I do think there's something about that time that is useful, actually, for storytelling. And this has been widely commented upon, even in the more commercial world of, you know, tech startups and, you know, projects like that here in the Bay Area. Those post-boom moments, the kind of the dips, they're more interesting. And they're more interesting because there's just more space. There's both, people are a little more desperate in some ways, which leads to some interesting things. And also, there's no Facebook and no, you know, rampant Google offering anyone and everyone $200,000 a year to come and do great work and be comfortable. And instead, you have to sort of strike out on your own. And of course, you know, I'm always on the side of the person striking out on their own or taking the weird night shift at the 24-hour bookstore. And so those are the stories I like. So I do think something about this moment of kind of riding the dip and trying to make your way through to the other side that just, I just think it works better for telling interesting stories.
Yeah, it's funny. When you said that, it made me think of another book that I did a while ago, almost a year ago on the show now, which is a mystery called Bellwether Rhapsody. And it is set in this hotel in the middle of a blizzard. And it's in 1996, I believe. And I was talking to the author about it, and she was talking about how, well, of course, you have to set a mystery in the 1990s, like before the advent of cell phones and Google, because, you know, there's one point where the two main characters are separated, and she's like, you know, if if it's now, they just like text each other and it'll be like, oh, I'm in the basement, where are you? And so you can't have that. And, you know, you don't recognize this person. You just Google them to figure out who they are. And so it's interesting. I hadn't really thought about your book in the context of, well, here's a mystery that you can still have even in the present day.
Right. And a mystery that, in fact, depends on some of, you know, sort of the tools that are employed for the solution of the mystery, maybe are like very high tech tools and things that wouldn't have been available even a few years ago. That struggle is so real. And I've talked to so many people about it, the sort of the advent of the cell phone and all the related technologies and the way that they just blow away like half of the go-to plots. And so there's kind of two, it forks in two directions. One is if I was a scholar of English, or, you know, and I studied novels, I would start to collect the data to see if stories are piling up in terms of like the date that stories are set in. I have a theory that there are hypothesis that they're piling up in the mid 90s. I think there's we're going to see that as sort of a wall there, a story wall. And if you set your story anytime before that, you know, from whatever antiquity all the way up through the advent of like these digital communications technologies, you're good. You can tell these kind of stories. But if you set your story after that, you have to answer these. You have to basically just be more inventive, and we're probably going to have to invent new kinds of stories and also new ways to depict these technologies on the page, which is actually more of a challenge than it seems. We have the tools for things like conversation, dialogue, and, you know, action. The tools for depicting text messages and the way that digital communication kind of bleeds into the real world, those are totally unsettled. Everyone's kind of doing it their own way.
Well, and that actually makes me think of another book we did, a book called The 100-Year House by Rebecca Mackay, another kind of mystery told backwards in a really interesting way, which also it's told backwards in time, but it begins in the mid-1990s, I think, for very much the reasons that we're talking about. But what's interesting about that, too, and we talked about this on the show, was that she has a lot of kind of obscure references that if you take the time to look them up, are actually kind of windows into understanding what is going on in the book. And that actually reminds me of your book in a way as well, because I noticed that a lot of the characters' last names seem to have meaning that, again, maybe open up some windows into an understanding. And when I talked with Rebecca Mackay about that in her book and said, you know, why choose to make the references obscure and kind of make the reader do work? She's like, well, in today's day, when everyone is reading with their phone in their hand, it's not that much work to ask someone to kind of look it up. And so if they do that, they are given additional understanding. And I wonder if that was part of your thinking, too, in your choices of some of these names.
Yes. No, it definitely was. And there's two parts to that. One is anytime someone tells me that they read the book, you know, with Google open off to the side or making a note of things to Google later, it just like makes my brain light up and makes my heart glow. It's so great. Like, what an amazing, wonderful way to read. And the idea that then you're sending people out down these rabbit holes on the internet to discover cool and interesting stuff is just the best. But then sort of as a corollary, particularly for a book about codes and mysteries, and also I think probably writing any kind of book now in the age of Google and the age of access to this information, it felt deeply wrong to me for anything, any word, any name, any number almost to be not a secret signal of some kind. I took that really seriously, the responsibility that if there's something specific, and literally sometimes it's even the numbers on the page, it could be as simple as the fact that it's a prime number and not just another boring even number, but you can be assured that I thought about it. And if possible, I tried to leave a little bit breadcrumb to something else.
Oh, I feel like I have to go back now and look at all the numbers on the pages. I often like to talk about endings on the show, and I really like to talk about epilogues, and in particular, authors' choices to provide them or to leave them out. So you could have ended this book with the revelation of the mystery solution, but you didn't. You chose to give us a little more, a little postscript. So what was your thinking there?
Well, this is where we come back around to being a reader first and forever primarily a reader. As a reader, I love epilogues. I just love them. I love the way they can make you feel. I love the sense of this sort of sprawling thing moving out into history. I love the idea that the story was part of history. It wasn't just this funny little self-contained bubble, but was kind of woven into larger things, and might come from my, you know, my predilection for things like fantasy and science fiction, where a lot of it is the world building, you know, and it's the sense of how this story you've been following fits into this much larger tapestry of like myth and thousand year quests and all that stuff. Fantasy books like always have epilogues. So there's, for me, there's no question from the get-go that if possible, if at all reasonable, I would write an epilogue. And I've heard from many people who didn't like the epilogue in Penumbra. They, you know, found it, as you would other epilogues, they found it a little pat, a little like it wrapped things up a little too neatly, like they would have maybe liked to use their own imagination. And to all those responses, I say, glad to know it, but no. I am epilogue fan for life.
Yeah, I'm always torn because on the one hand, I've talked to authors who say, you know, well, life is always, we always kind of stop in the middle. Like there is no winding up, and there is a certain way in which it's more true to life to stop at a moment which doesn't feel like an ending. And I do believe that. And yet at the same time, the reader in me always does kind of want to know. And 10 years later, here's where everyone is and kind of wrap
and
it all up.
There's a particular feeling, I think, or sort of a palette of feelings that are part of the epilogue. And for some stories, they're just not appropriate. I think that's probably for stories that are a little harder edged, maybe stories that are a bit darker, a little rawer. But for stories that have a warmth already or try to achieve a kind of warmth and a like roundedness, I think the palette of the epilogue is just too pleasing to pass up. You know, the epilogue is all kind of melancholy and, you know, things finally coming together and, you know, hopes and dreams and ambitions and disappointments. And I don't know. I like, again, as a reader, I like all those feelings. I like feeling that way as I come to the end of a book. So yeah, if there's an epilogue, I am always in for it.
So I'm going to ask you one final question, and I'm going to tell you ahead of time that you can pass on this one if you want to, but you are the first author interview that I have done since the election. And I have been spending a lot of time thinking about this show and just the reading that I do, which is mostly reading fiction, and about whether and how that matters in today's world, in the world that we are living in post the election. And I wonder if you, as a writer, have any thoughts on that?
I do, and it's pretty simple. There's a thought for me that is and a reason to write and a reason to care about this stuff. It's pretty foundational, and which is good. It stands up to these tremors and these kind of big upsets. And it really has to do, it actually has to do with where we started and being a reader. I think of myself as a young reader, someone going to the Troy Public Library in Troy, Michigan, you know, every day. I basically lived there for many years of my youth. And the things I found there, you know, the choose your own adventure books and the weird books about science and the dinosaur picture books and Lord of the Rings and, you know, everything else. To me, that was so, so pivotal and so foundational for who I became. And there was so much simple pleasure in it, you know, even if it didn't have anything to do with my career or the things that I would write later. It was a wonderful way to be a child and to start to learn about the world and hear about. I have a lot of these other political questions, big political questions, everything, the economy, immigration, climate change, like everything else. Me, all of those things, when you think about kids and young and people coming into this country and into this world and what's available to them or not available to them, whether they're welcomed or not welcomed. And to me, books have such a huge role to play in people's lives. That for adults, there can be great pleasures, great introspections. You know, they're part of our culture and our lives, and they bring us pleasure too. But I think books are for young people more than anything else. And I think in this world that we're entering and, you know, the years we're going to try to get through ahead, they're just as important as they've ever been and probably more important. So the 12-year-olds walking into the public library on January 20th, 2017, let's keep writing books and talking about books for them.
Thank you. I really appreciate that. Robin, it's been great talking with you. Thank you so much for taking the time.
It has been my absolute pleasure. Thank you for the invitation.
I'm Sid Oppenheimer, and this is Book Talk on WNHH 103.5 FM. take a moment to introduce my guests. Tui Sutherland is the author of many books, including the best-selling Wings of Fire series. She was last on Book Talk discussing Lily Brooks Dalton's novel, Good Morning Midnight. Alfie Guy teaches writing at Yale University and last appeared on this show talking about Bob Prohl's novel, 100,000 Worlds. Alfie and Tui, thanks for joining me today.
Thank you, Sid.
So let's dive right in. This is a book that in a lot of ways is about reading, but I was really struck by the fact that Clay is only able to solve the mystery by listening to a book. Specifically, he listens to the audiobook of the Dragon Song Chronicles, which was his favorite series as a kid. And as it turns out, the author of the series, who also happens to be the reader of the audiobook, was a member of the fellowship that's trying to decode the mystery that Clay ultimately solves. But what did you make of that? That in order to solve this mystery about books, he had to listen, not to read.
Well, I thought it tied into the author's overall sort of respect for technology and the way that he doesn't sort of judge anyone for listening or reading in different ways. You know, he seemed to be equally happy with like ebook readers and audiobook listeners and people who use technology in various ways. I mean, it didn't bother me. And I like the way he described the difference between the audiobook experience and reading. I think it's page 236. He says, when you read a book, the story definitely happens inside your head. When you listen, it seems to happen in a little cloud all around it, like a fuzzy knit cap pulled down over your eyes. And I'm not much, I can't really like follow audiobooks. I tend not to listen to them. But I really liked that description and how he was equally comfortable sort of in both worlds. And you know, the fact that it's the author reading it themselves, that's kind of cool that the author is like the one who can kind of bring you into the experience even more by being the reader as well.
It's funny, you just made me think something I hadn't wondered before is, I wonder if Robin has made an audiobook of this book.
Well, indeed. I don't know what version of it you have, Alfie, but on the paperback version that I have, the very last page says, enjoy listening to Robin Sloan's Mr. Penumbra's 24-Hour Bookstore, narrated by Ari Fliakos. And then it says, contains exclusive bonus content, including a special chapter with an extra clue read by the author.
What?
Great. Oh, I wish I had seen that. Because, as you know from reading the book, that's how he spots it, is that there are secret clues in the Moffat book when he listens to them that weren't in the printed edition. That's really, I love that. That's so meta.
Yeah, that's amazing.
The other thing I was thinking about, Sid, when if I think of it as an audio book, I think about technology. But when you said he could only pick something up by listening to it, then I thought about technology going the other direction, that you know, this is a book about reading, and there are some really direct discussions of how people should read and if they should read and why they should read. But, you know, before reading, there was storytelling. And so it makes me think about some truth that you can't even get. You know, I think one way I read this book, and you might have questions lined up about this theme already, but one way I read this book was about first giving you your fear that reading on the internet is bad and then complicating it. And so if I take this question about listening, I think, oh, it's saying that books themselves are an advanced technology and there's some deeper truth hidden in an even older version, which is just listening.
That's true. I do feel like all the way through, he has this sort of, he sort of can see the magic in everything. I love the way he describes technology and sort of the sort of modern world in a very fantastical way. I mean, he mentioned in that interview the warehouses, and like, how do you make a warehouse feel like a fantasy world? But he totally does, with like the shelves just like whizzing around, and he anthropomorphizes them by talking about them like wiggling like children, like lined up, you know, in a kindergarten class or something. And he does that especially with Google. Like, I felt like the way he described Google, it felt like a whole fantasy world that you'd wandered into Narnia. That's how it felt like to me, like the way he describes the Google campus with like the brass band over here playing an algorithm generated waltz and the people like making self-driving cars and working on immortality, and then like the hyper-personalized meals where you can have like it exactly like, you know, for your body hacking like plan. It really felt magical. I feel like he can do that with almost everything. Like, I feel like he can see the magic in all the different kinds of storytelling and technology and the various worlds we live in. I really admired that about how he wrote about his writing.
I was curious about what you guys made of that, about his choice to kind of employ these fantastical elements, or even to kind of keep returning to these themes of fantasy. Like, he refers several times to himself as, you know, as he and his friend Neil and his girlfriend Kat are the warrior, the rogue, and the wizard, these formulas of fantasy that he is kind of writing into his own life, and how you felt that functioned in the novel.
I loved it. I really thought he captured that. He actually talked a little bit in his interview about what I loved was when he talked about how books are for young people. And I think that seeing the world in that magical way, like, is something that we often lose as we grow older. And so to recapture that in a story like this, the feeling of like, I'm on an adventure and like anything magical could happen at any moment. And this is, I'm this character in this adventure story. He has a line when they're at the library of the Unbroken Spine, where they open up the secret bookshelf, and it says, he looks at Neil and he's like, I know we're both thinking the same thing. I have waited my whole life to walk through a secret passage built into a bookshelf. And I was like, yes, me too. And I loved that. I really felt like he did. It felt that way. The whole book felt like the real world, but you could still find magic in it. And I thought he did a great job bringing the fantasy world in, like making it all feel like a big fantasy.
Can we talk a little bit more about friendship in this novel? I thought it was interesting. You know, at the very end, in the last like three paragraphs, he says, there is no immortality that is not built on friendship and work done with care. And earlier, Clay succeeds in decoding this message that Griffo Gerritsen has left in the punches that are used to create his font. And the message, it says, thank you, Teobaldo. You are my greatest friend. This has been the key to everything. And Teobaldo, of course, is Teobaldo Minucius, who was one of the first to discover printing, and he and Griffo Gerritsen are the closest of friends. So I think that Robin returns to this again and again, this idea that somehow friendship is the key to immortality or to what really matters in life. And I'm wondering about the ways you see that playing out in the course of the novel.
And this connects a little bit to your previous question too, Sid. I thought Neil's and Clay's friendship, which was structured by shared experience of being a particular kind of kid at a particular time, I really liked the way the story kept drawing upon that. We are told about Clay, and I guess a realization he comes to about himself during the book is he is a kind of person who has friends with special talents. For me, Neil was the one that it felt the truest of. Occasionally, I thought some of the other, like that Matt happens to be someone who's really good at making things, and then it turns out that he needs to have a fake book made. That seemed a little plottish rather than thematic.
Well, it's interesting because I felt like he was almost consciously playing with kind of the formulas of fantasy there, where like the thing you need is in fact around the corner. And
not just fantasy, but heist stories where everyone has a particular skill that fits exactly into the thing that you're looking for. And he kind of plays with that later when he talks about how you're such a resourceful young man. And he's like, yeah, I do have resources. Like, who's the one friend I haven't used yet? Like, and it's Oliver with his connection to the ancient stuff that finds him the punches.
Right. Yeah, it's like in a fantasy novel or in a heist novel, no one is there just to be there. Like, they all have to serve some function.
Mm-hmm.
And so the question is, I think, how in a novel like this, which is not strictly one thing or another, it's kind of genre bending in that way, how do you write a novel where everyone kind of serves their purpose, but is also a real person and where the friendships feel genuine and complicated and nuanced?
Well, I really like you're using the term heist movie, because it does account for something about this book that I liked. Because in a fantasy, it's true that, you know, just to go to the Lord of the Rings, most people are there for some racial characteristic, like dwarves, elves, like, you know, the fellowship is made up of all these different kinds of peoples, and they each have a moment where the thing that their people are good at is what is needed. But in a lot of fantasy texts, they're always all together. In other words, all nine of them are traveling together all of the time. And once in a while, one of them comes forward. And this felt more modern and realistic in that people gathered in different kinds of groups, and then you would call your friend when you needed something. I really like it as a caper movie or as a heist movie. That really makes sense to me. And then, and that the friendship is in doing the things together. It's not that he and Matt are so deeply connected before he asks Matt for help. It's that they become better friends through their sharing each other's skills and talents.
Kind of in keeping with that, I talked with Robin a little bit about the names in this book and all the kind of little clues to a deeper understanding. And I feel like just as every person has a particular role to play, in most cases, the name seems to signal what that role is or how we should be understanding them. Would you guys agree with that? I mean, so to play it out a little bit, you know, you have Kat and her last name is Potente, right? Which means power. And mm-hmm. she kind of brings the power of Google and the power of technology to this effort to solve the mystery, which doesn't...
And Kat also makes you think of like witches and wizards, cats. Like it has that, that ties into the sort of like her role as the wizard in the story too, I think.
But I wanted to, you know, get your thoughts on like what we're supposed to make of a couple of the names like Clay and Penumbra, because with Clay, I feel like, you know, in some ways it's like the return to the earth, right? Like it's the thing that is solid, but also boring. You know, he's the one who has all the friends with special talents, but what is his talent? But it's also the thing that's kind of grounding, right? Like the most fundamental.
Well, you know, what's funny is that Clay is the name of the dragon in my first...
That is true. That is true. I didn't know that. And what did you mean by it?
Well, it was exactly the same thing. He's the one that you kind of overlook. He's sort of the quiet, ordinary character, but who ends up being really important because he cements everyone together. Like he's the foundation of everything. He's like the whole reason that the friendship works, that the five of them stick together, is because of him being there, kind of in the center of it. And I think that's true of this Clay as well. It was a really, I thought about that because I was like, oh, it's another Clay. That's perfect.
This is not really a disagreement, but I would go in another direction with the Clay of Penumbra, which is, I thought, unformed, that Clay is what mm-hmm. you could call the protagonist of, you know, any Judd Apatow movie at the beginning. I'm an undeveloped young man. I haven't had to grow up yet. The women around me are a little further ahead, but I have something of self-knowledge, and then I will be more full, and then I could be changed. My name could be changed, you know, to Vessel or you know, Pot. But right now I'm Clay. And I think it does make, you know, he does come into his own towards the end. Like he finally does something himself, like takes a few individual risks and then has some achievement as a result of it.
Well, I also Googled his last name because after Robin agreed that, yes, that all these things are hidden in the book for you to find, I started Googling everything. And Janin brings up Jean Janin, who was also a designer of typography. For years, the font Garamond was mistakenly attributed to him. And Garamond seems to be the font that Gerritsen is referring to, the one that was always comes installed with everything on the Mac. And so in some ways, this fellow Janin is like the imposter, the one who is the faux designer. And I think that's kind of in keeping with what you're saying, Alfie, about, you know, Clay doesn't see himself as the creator of anything original until maybe the end when he and Penumbra go off to kind of start this new endeavor. But for much of the book, he is someone who I think feels like kind of like an imposter.
Well, I think this is not very important, but I would go back to before he calls Oliver and then and therefore finds the Gerritsen punches, he does say to himself, just something that one of you just repeated, what is it? What is my talent? Oh, yeah, I know people. That's my talent. So mm-hmm. I feel like from when Deckel challenges him to find the punches, from then forward, Clay has some agency. Like, and you're right that at the end, he's going to maybe create something even better. I totally accept that. But I feel like he goes from being a passive wannabe to, you know, the scene where Kent carries him around the party as a talking head, and the computer feels like that's appropriate to his floatiness as a character in his own life up until that point.
Well, and the thing that he ends up doing at the end, right, if you look at page 285, he says, I will admit that I just want an excuse to put all my favorite people in a room together. Yeah. So we'll form this consultancy. But the consultancy is basically about connecting people. Like, that's what he is a connector.
Well, and one of the things that I thought was interesting, this is a little bit of a tangent, but I thought that to place him as sort of the hero of the story, I think in a lot of ways you could also have told this story as the people who are trying to bring technology into the book, the old ancient book world, are the bad guys. Like, I feel like that's sort of a cliche that you see all the time in fantasy, that like, oh no, I mean, there's a line at one point where they put it up on the Google screens and he's like, it's not a book anymore, it's a data dump. And you're like, oh my God, it's like, like, that's so malevolent. And yet he totally doesn't frame it that way. Like, all the things that Clay does that you think are going to be terrible, like stealing the logbook or you know, imposing Google onto this ancient text, like, end up, it's not evil. It's like, it's kind of wonderful in the end. And I think part of how he does that is by, like, the fact that Penumbra is so excited about it all the way along.
I'd love to, if it's okay, I'd love to talk more about that too. You're getting to something I think is really surprising about this book and that I really enjoyed. I also thought of, obviously, the Google people are going to be the bad people here. Like, that's you know, given that it's a book about a bookstore, I thought, well, and they themselves, you know, someone makes a little reference. Oh, sorry. Oh, you run a bookstore? Sorry. Oh, you don't realize we're putting you out of business. And when Penumbra thinks Clay wants to join the Unbroken Spine, he says, well, just tell your friend, he has to promise to read deeply. And I thought, well, scanning books and running them through an algorithm, that's got to be the opposite of reading deeply. So when Penumbra is excited, I haven't read the short story, Sid, and you have, but I felt like, oh, this book just decided to be a different book.
Yeah.
Like, not going to be a book about the evils of technology. It's going to be a book about how anything you do has to be done with a certain spirit. Anything you do is going to have problems and potential. And, you know, you got to keep pushing for the potential, something like that.
Oh, and the whole, that theme that keeps the line that keeps coming up, Festina Lente, that I looked up, it's like, make haste slowly. And it's like, I feel like that's exactly what you just described.
Good. I didn't look it up. You guys did so much. Impressed.
Google, Alfie, Google. Did you end up being convinced by that argument? Because I will admit that I am a bit of a Luddite and maybe a little resistant to technology and still very wedded to my books in paper form. And I found myself, yeah, a little bit resisting his argument that, oh, no, it's all fine. There was something in me that resisted, you know, his when he does his data visualization. And he's able to see, you know, this pattern that it has taken all the other members of the fellowship years to trace out. I thought that's too easy and that's too simple. And like, there's something to be said for having to like put hard work in and to have to earn it.
And yet on the, well, yes, because they do say that it's cheating.
It does feel like cheating. It does feel a little bit like cheating.
But on the other hand, did you feel like all the old people who had spent all of these years decoding these books had like really done something useful with their lives? Like, I felt kind of sorry for them that they had just been like slowly plodding through this coding and it was going to get them to sort of nowhere in the end.
Well, that's the other thing is that, you know, for a book that's all about bookstores and books, no one seems to read anything.
Huh.
Except for, you know, the Moffat series. But he's read that as a 12-year-old and he listens to it again. But you never see people reading a book.
Right, because the Codex Vitae, you mean, you're really just decoding them. You're not reading them.
Right.
Right.
That's true.
That's interesting.
And so the bookstore does close down, which is not to say that, you know, there shouldn't be progress and that new and wonderful things can't emerge, but also maybe it is important to acknowledge that, like, with new and beautiful things, sometimes is the loss of old and beautiful things.
Yeah, I mean, I see what you mean. I feel like he did convince me that there is just as much magic in the new things as there are in the old things. Like, and I think he has a lot of respect, you know, the way he talks about the Google, how Google, even Google respects the old tech, the old knowledge. They keep calling it the okay, and how they can never really quite capture it. But at the same time,
The old knowledge is such a fantasy term, by the way. Don't you love it? Like, it's so Narnia, the
yes.
old knowledge.
Yeah, you're right. The magic from before time. That's
Yes,
good.
it's true. You know, I must admit I'm sort of an optimist about the world. So I feel like it's possible for the old knowledge and books to coexist with Google and data visualization and all the pretty new shiny things, the whizzing around shelves in the warehouse. I think it's all kind of magical, and it's okay to see them all that way. And I feel like he captured that so beautifully.
I want to ask one final thing before we have to wrap it up. But as I mentioned to both of you in an email I sent a couple of weeks ago, I realized completely unexpectedly that the cover of this book glows in the dark, which I only found out because I turned off the light as I was like leaving the room, and I was like holding the book in my hand, and I was like, oh my God, this book glows, which was awesome, but also made me think about the fact that so much of this book takes place in the dark. That Clay has this night shift, this overnight shift at the 24-hour bookstore. That in New York, he goes down into this vault at nighttime, and I wondered what you guys made of that.
That's a good question, Sid, but I don't know because I didn't, except for the scene in the reading room, I don't think I imagined this book in darkness, even though it does all take place, a ton of it takes place at night. I agree with you about that. But I didn't think of it as, I guess I just didn't think of it as in darkness. I was thinking more about 24 hours, being up on the internet, searching all the time, there being no natural daylight, and you can always reach everyone everywhere. Like I was thinking, like, when I was thinking about time or light or nighttime at all in terms of this book, it was about the banishment of night as a time of quiet and, you know,
Sleep.
yeah. Rather than about recognizing that, oh yeah, what does it mean that so much of it takes place at night? I mean, that we are constantly reminded that someone came in at 2:30 in the morning. So that's a good question. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, I don't entirely know either, but I was thinking a little bit about the way that some things only come out in the dark, and that there are things that we only are aware of in the dark. And the cover of the book was kind of made me think of that the first time, this idea that we think of being able to see only in daylight, but
Right.
actually it was only when the lights were off that I could see the cover doing this thing. And maybe there's something about, you know, the lights being out that enables Clay to kind of encounter this whole other world that he is then able to explore.
Well, when you say that, then for me, Google and everything it represents is the sunlight. In other
Yeah,
words, like
totally.
that becomes the thing that's shining so brightly that you can't recognize that there are things you can't use it to see. Not again, it doesn't make the book anti-technology, of course not, but it does say in our, you know, if I think now of the scene, the decoding scene that falls flat, and if I think of what you're saying about darkness, that, you know, some things are revealed in darkness, I think, okay, so that scene is about shining the brightest possible light onto something is not the only way to see all of it.
Well, and but you need to have both. It's a 24-hour,
Yeah,
right? It's a
you're right.
24-hour.
Not a nighttime bookstore. You're right. You're
You
right.
gotta go. So you do need both. That's cool. Sid, can I say? Can I also go back to the last thing that Robin was talking about, the importance of books
Yes.
in our world? Because I loved that so much. Like everything he
Great.
said at the
That was
end.
a great moment of the interview.
Thank you.
Yeah,
Yes.
I mean, and certainly, like I couldn't agree more that I think books are. And books for young people especially are so important in today's world, and how they can shape you into a new person. I mean, maybe that connects to the idea that his name is Clay, and he starts off unformed and gets shaped over the course of the book. But I think that's true, and I think also they build empathy. I think that's the other important thing that books do, and that makes them so important in today's post-election world. But always.
I found myself thinking a lot about the last paragraph of the book, which I'm going to read out loud. A man walking fast down a dark, lonely street, quick steps and hard breathing, all wonder and need. A bell above a door and the tinkle it makes. A clerk and a ladder and warm golden light. And then the right book exactly. at exactly the right time. And I was thinking about that because 3 days after the election, an agent I know sent me a book, and she said, I'm not sending you this book as an ask. I know you have a long reading list and you probably have a lot of books already for the show, but I just thought you might want to read this book right now. And it is a book called This Is How It Always Is by an author named Lori Frankel. And it is about a family with 5 children, one of whom turns out to be transgender. But it's really a book about parenting and love and trying to make good choices for your children and not knowing how to do that and making mistakes. And it is a book that confronts a lot of things about hate and prejudice, but ends with a real sense of like hope and optimism and love. And I had been for those 3 days post-election, like unable to read anything. And that never happens to me. And then I read this book and it was a book that totally took me in. And I was thinking about that, you know, exactly the right book at exactly the right time. And it was the book that I needed. And I think sometimes, you know, that is what we need, is we need that right book at exactly the right time. And so, especially now, we need to keep looking for them.
That sounds amazing. I'm requesting it right now.
And we will be talking about it on the show in March. So mark your calendars. Alfie and Tui, as ever, it has been great talking with you. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you, Sid. That was awesome.
Yeah, that was really fun. Thanks a lot. Nice to talk to both of you.
I'm Sid Oppenheimer, and this is Book Talk on WNHH 103.5 FM. Next up, New Haven librarian Lucy Cochran recommends the middle grade novel, Inkheart, by Cornelia Funk.
Hi, I'm Lucy Cochran, children's librarian at the New Haven Free Public Library. I'm here to recommend and review a children's book, Inkheart, by Cornelia Funk. 12-year-old Maggie has lived alone with her father for as long as she can remember, since her mother went away. She is surprised to learn that her father, who repairs and binds books, can read fictional characters out of their books and into the real world. Maggie is also surprised to learn that her mother was read into a book. When one of the characters abducts her father and tries to force him into service, Maggie must go after him. Can she save her father and find her mother? The first in the Ink World trilogy, this is an engrossing fantasy for anyone who loves books. There is plenty of action, adventure, and magic. The real world part of the book is set in Italy. This story within a story is for anyone who has ever used their imagination to put themselves into a fictional world. The characters are very detailed. This book is recommended for children ages 9 to 12, and can be found with the chapter books in the fiction section of the New Haven Free Public Library Children's Room downtown or at our neighborhood branches. Our librarians are happy to assist with readers' advisory questions. As a reminder, all books discussed in Book Talk can be found at the New Haven Free Public Library.
Thanks, Lucy. We're taking a short break for the holidays, but we'll be back on January 25th talking about the novel The Winter in Anna, first with the author, Reed Karaim, and then with my guests, Jennifer Eng and Alice Baumgartner. We have amazing books coming up in February, March, and April. Check them out on our website, booktalkradio.net, and order them today. As ever, you can share your thoughts about this episode or any other on Facebook or Twitter, or email me directly at booktalkwnhh@gmail.com. And for the sake of that 12-year-old walking into the Troy, Michigan Public Library on January 21st, let's all keep reading and talking about books.